There is a small police station in a densely populated entertainment and nightlife district of Tokyo called Shibuya. Huge numbers of young people from all over Tokyo and beyond meet their friends there to hang out. Near the end of my five-year stay in Tokyo, one of the newspapers ran a story about how over the preceding several years, this police station had lent a staggering sum of money to young people needing transportation money to get home. Teenagers being, as Don and Debbie will soon find out if they don't already know it, rather forgetful about holding something in reserve. The amount they lent over this period of a few years was something like $1 million. It's not as much as it sounds like, since around that time, cantaloupe in Tokyo were selling for about $70 a piece. But $1 million is still a lot of money. The police had a notebook in which the young people would write their names and addresses, promising to mail the money back when they got home. The Shibuya police got back over 99% of what they lent. This looks like a miracle, but actually the success rate of these banker constables is not hard to understand. They only needed to know one simple fact about their borrowers, that they were Japanese, which virtually guaranteed that they were raised on a very strong ethic of promise-keeping. The story of our own recent history in lending and borrowing money is not ending with newspaper articles about how well it all has worked. This morning, we look at why. Over the last decade or so, Congress made changes in the legal and regulatory framework that made it easier to borrow money to buy a home. The financial services industry began lending to home buyers who previously would not have been considered financially qualified. This meant that the loan portfolios of our banks and savings and loan associations got riskier. In response, investment banks began to offer new investment vehicles that were supposed to distribute these new risks more broadly. The new vehicles were forms of securities called derivatives. The assets underlying them were large bundles of home mortgages. New homeowners bought homes and borrowed. Banks lent. The borrowers were drawn in by low initial interest rates in many cases, rates that jumped much higher after an initial honeymoon period. Many were told not to worry about the higher house payments. If it turned out they didn't have the income when the interest rate on their loan jumped, they could always just refinance the mortgage, since housing values would continue to go up. Then they could use the proceeds to pay the mortgage until they either could handle the payment or could sell the house at a large profit, because once again, housing values would continue to go up. But they didn't continue to go up. The initial low rates on those seductive mortgages expired and much higher ones kicked in. Payments could not be made. Mortgages went into foreclosure. Now, although this is bad, the mishandling of home loans did not get us to where we are today. Between 2000 and 2007, the gross domestic product of the United States was $92.5 trillion. Current estimates of the losses due to improvident lending are only in the range of $1 trillion or so. Only a trillion. To some observers, the new derivatives look like the cause of our woes, but really, they're just the messengers. These derivatives were so seductive that the investment banks who created them fell in love with their own financial sculpture, a kind of bizarre Wall Street version of Pygmalion and Galatea. They used money they borrowed from foreign sources at low interest rates to invest in these derivatives, which paid them higher interest rates. It seemed like found money. These investment vehicles were exempted from the usual regulatory requirements. Alan Greenspan told Congress to do this. Congress did as it was told. So when the downturn hit, the investment banks were overextended because the relaxed regulatory environment let them be overextended. And they all knew, of course, that housing prices would continue to go up. When Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers sank, their debt-equity ratios were about 33-1. For every dollar of their own capital they were investing, they were also investing $33 of borrowed funds. So it only took about a 3% decline in the value of their investments to make them insolvent. When the housing bubble burst, that's what they were. Lehman Brothers had asked AIG, the American Insurance Group, a large insurance multinational, for an insurance policy against the risk of loss on their heavy investment in mortgage-backed derivatives. AIG said yes, and Lehman paid AIG an insurance premium. AIG didn't set the premium very high because it fully expected housing prices would continue to go up. So when Lehman told AIG they were facing a massive loss on their investments in mortgage-backed derivatives, AIG didn't have the money to pay on the insurance policy. So what did they do? They picked up the phone and explained the situation to the United States government and said, "We need $80 billion in the next couple of days." Immediately, Merrill Lynch and Goldman Sachs, two other investment banks not that different from Lehman, were in negotiations to be acquired. None of the healthy banks watching all this from the sidelines had any idea who else was affected, including the banks standing next to them on the sidelines, banks that they were eyeing nervously and wondering, how healthy are they? If blue chips like Lehman and Merrill Lynch, Goldman Sachs, and AIG could either disappear overnight or be seen throwing themselves on the mercy of federal regulators, who else? Who next? Large financial institutions participate in all manner of mundane movements of huge amounts of money simply to make the complex financial machinery work. But now, after trundling a wheelbarrow full of money across Wall Street to a neighboring bank, expecting the money to come back in a wheelbarrow in a few days in the normal ebb and flow, a healthy bank faced the very real possibility that regulators would move in while their wheelbarrow was over there and wrap the moral equivalent of yellow crime scene tape around the neighboring bank. The credit system was locking up. There was and is no trust. Now, the sharp declines in the stock market over the last few weeks are not indicative of a large loss of real economic value. The strength of America's income-generating assets is not significantly impaired, even after writing off the bad debts and related losses. Nor do these declines in the stock market indicate a technical malfunction of some kind in the complex financial machinery. There is nothing inherently wrong with gathering up bundles of mortgages and packaging them and selling them as investment securities. Rather, these declines should be taken as a strong signal from investors that they don't know who or what they can trust anymore, which makes investing more like going to Las Vegas. They're selling a lot of stock to reduce their risk, and when the market is flooded with sell orders, the price goes down sharply. Without trust, all that valuable economic machinery that we have can't move smoothly and thus can't generate confidence-inspiring earnings. It is not a problem of liquidity. There's plenty of financial water. The problem is the financial horses have hydrophobia. And well, they should. Well, they should, now that it has become clear that a portion of the water supply of undetermined size and precise location is toxic. The water got tainted because of a large number of closely connected individual choices by people participating in the financial system. The important question is, why did it happen that all those people aligned on exactly the fateful pattern of choices needed to trigger a crisis? Here are three of the answers on offer in the marketplace of ideas to that question. First, Alan Greenspan. He says the answer is greed. In a speech a few days ago, he described our market economy as based on trust and an appreciation that reputation, meaning a reputation for honesty and integrity, has a significant economic value. He says he is distressed at how far we have let concerns for reputation slip in recent years. Greenspan is a devoted follower of Ayn Rand and her philosophy of objectivism, which is a form of radical individualism. In 1967, Rand included a Greenspan essay in her book celebrating the virtues of pure and absolute free market capitalism. In it, Greenspan declared, "It is in the self-interest of every businessman to have a reputation for honest dealings and a quality product. It requires years of consistently excellent performance. A company cannot afford to risk its years of investment by letting down its standards of quality," now here's the really good part, "for one moment or for one inferior product, nor would it be tempted by any potential quick killing." Nobody out there trying to make any quick killings, is there? Not in America. In Greenspan's view, individual entrepreneurs may underestimate the importance of reputation, but the market will assure that they are disciplined for this. The invisible hand is supposed to turn these misbehaving flouters of reputational decency over the invisible knee and give them a good, hard, invisible spanking, in the very visible and painful form of customers taking their patronage elsewhere. The great virtue of the free market system is supposed to be precisely that it doesn't depend on trust. So what on earth is Alan Greenspan talking about? To Greenspan, the flouters of reputational decency are the few bad apples in every barrel, but never a large portion of the whole crop. For Alan Greenspan, that just doesn't compute in his worldview. His way of looking at the world simply can't account for participants in the market behaving in this reputation-ignoring, reckless way en masse. Just can't explain it. Second, Paul Krugman. This Nobel Prize-winning liberal economist agrees with Greenspan that the cause of the crisis is greed. Also like Greenspan, he offers no theory for why greed is so widespread these days, but he sounds like he thinks it's inevitable. The medicine he prescribes is stricter regulation, but he never addresses the poor track record of regulation in preventing lapses in business ethics. Tighter regulations have been adopted many times over the past few decades. We reviewed a passel of them in a Lifespan Faith Development program a little over a year ago, centering around the Enron debacle. The regulations often come along after a crisis, but they're never agile enough to keep up with the human ingenuity that is devoted to finding ways to evade them. In many cases, including in the current financial crisis, regulators and watchdog agency have actually been enablers of the problematic behavior. A third perspective on the basic theme of greed comes from a relatively new school of thought called behavioral finance, which attempts to look at investing behavior in psychological terms. One such behavioralist, James Grant, says, "People keep stepping on rakes because money, like romance, is only partly an intellectual experience. Money," he says, "like sex, brings out some thought, but also much heavy breathing and little stored knowledge. Some people learn from their ancestors," he says, "but mostly they repeat the same mistakes. Thus it has always been, and thus it will always be." Another behavioralist, Robert Shiller, sees the current financial crisis as an example of what he calls a thought virus that people mistook for the truth, the thought that housing prices would continue to escalate forever. He seems to attribute the thought viruses to something like the power of suggestion, but offers no explanation for why large numbers of people are suggestible on some themes or under some circumstances, but not on other themes or under other circumstances. These psychological theories do seem to me to be getting closer to the heart of the matter. The scenarios that large numbers of participants in the financial system were banking on, literally banking on, rested on a mass delusion about housing prices going up forever. Not everyone had this thought virus, but enough of us did to infect the whole system. And many of us who consider ourselves immune were at least silent enablers. When the housing market or the stock market is going up, no one wants to be a wet blanket by asking questions like, "Is it possible that we're bidding things up in a collective frenzy of wish fulfillment?" Possibly the most telltale sign of the mass delusion was the presence of Alan Greenspan with his absurdly out-of-touch theories about the value of reputation. I wish they weren't out of touch. I wish they were tremendously in touch and in vogue, but they're not. From 1987 to 2006, Greenspan was the single most important figure in the largest financial empire in human history. He was not just playing the role of an accomplished technocrat. "He had a way of speaking that made you think he knew exactly what he was talking about at all times," said one Democratic senator. "He was the oracle, and who were you to question him?" In that 1967 Ayn Rand book that included Greenspan's essay, Rand herself wrote a piece entitled, "America's Persecuted Minority, Big Business." We placed an acolyte, Greenspan, of a genuine extremist, Rand, a militant foe of government regulation, in charge of oversight of our financial system for 19 years. Our credulous following of Greenspan's puck-led parade suggests a delusional seduction, a vain hope that something magical would happen if we just let the sorcerers do their thing. And to me, Paul Krugman's regulatory prescriptions have an unsettling mirror image resemblance to those of Greenspan. When we are in the thrall of our delusional hope that the market will magically make us rich, a shaman like Greenspan is ascendant. When those hopes are dashed, we yearn instead for the equally weak magic of the law as an antidote, and shamans like Krugman are ascendant. Nowhere in these binges and mood swings do we ask the question buried underneath all the wreckage. Why do people fall into a pattern of delusionally greedy behavior en masse? Emotional decisions and behaviors usually arise in response to some pre-existing emotional need. The first need every human being must address is affirmation of his self-worth. Now we're talking about theology. Now we're in my country. To be authentic, this affirmation of self-worth must be generated from within us. At the same time, we face a struggle in separating an authentic sense of self-worth from a mere internalizing of how our community values us. A community's expression of such valuations of people, be it a local community or a broader one, comes to us through culture. Unfortunately, in American society, our culture has pretty tightly linked self-worth to competition and success, which in turn are tightly linked to material wealth. This is no news flash. You know this. You've seen it everywhere. In emotional and spiritual terms, our survival depends on affirmation of self-worth. It's no wonder, then, that we will betray trust and do other desperate things just to have an unlikely shot at getting it, even deluding ourselves into taking foolhardy risks. This struggle to affirm self-worth is misguided and even addictive, because authentic affirmation of self-worth cannot be generated by keeping up with the ever-present Joneses. But we keep doing it. So the massive bailout now underway may or may not work for a little while, but it will not address the addictive pattern. That will continue, and thus business ethics crises will continue until a different cultural ethic of self-worth replaces the pathological one we have now. That can be generated only in communities that are able to gain a perspective that transcends or gets outside of the pattern we've been running. The only communities I see that even have a shot at that are religious ones. I'm not sorry that the market-worshipping and regulation-worshipping hypotheses of Alan Greenspan and Paul Krugman are failures. I'm not sorry about it. If they were successful, it would mean that the human spirit, our godly capacity for imagination, creativity, and choice, is small enough to be subjugated by a set of principles. It would mean that the human need for self-affirmation can be satisfied by systems in which we are not much more than rats in a Skinner box, cruising around our maze on an invisible leash held by an invisible hand, or marched around it at gunpoint by regulators who themselves have no bigger aspirations than good behavior. Our salvation will not be found in mechanisms of the market or the government that try to eliminate the possibility of widespread bad choices. Rather, we will find our way to it in loving communities that help us stay connected to our noble nature. We all have big-hearted selves whose worth is affirmed by expressing love and compassion into the world. Our striving to affirm self-worth by material accumulation is tragic, but our noble, heroic capacities are revealed in the tragedy itself. Looking back, we can see how the story might have been written differently. And that's what tragedy is all about. That story is the one we are working on, writing and rewriting it from week to week in this church and others like it. I believe that breaking the cycle of our endlessly morphing business ethics crisis has to begin here. And I believe it can begin here and immediately, with reaching out to each other during the rough times we surely are in for in this financial crisis. In all of our spiritual practices and community life, we can say to each other in many different ways, here, your self-worth doesn't depend on the almighty dollar. We can know and be known by one another. We can help one another see the middle of our own backs, to use a phrase we've been using around here lately. We can help each other see what's been running our lives without our knowing it fully. A community like this can stay awake to what a genuine sense of self-worth really is. The gods of the copybook headings demand propitiation. It is a loving demand that we should honor. Let's bring those copybooks back. Let's look every day at the old wisdoms and write them down again and again until they're second nature. All that glitters is not gold. What goes up really does have to come down. And a long journey begins with a single step. And since we're Unitarian Universalists, let's have some pages in the back of the copybooks with no headings. We're brash enough to suppose that we ourselves might come up with some new old wisdoms to contribute to this humble tradition. As those gods would remind us, practice makes perfect. We can improve our penmanship, and in the bargain, with a little luck, our deportment. Amen.